Good morning. It's a privilege to be here with y'all today. In the time that we have together, I want us to consider and to explore really the deep things of God, what He's like. As the title of these addresses would indicate, we're going to be looking at the attributes of God. First, we'll look at, just generally speaking, what the attributes of God are. Then, with the rest of the time we have this morning and then this afternoon, we'll look at two different divine attributes to kind of give us a kind of representative examples of what these divine attributes are. You can quickly move through a lot of attributes of God, or you can choose just a few and look a little bit deeper at them. I think it's profitable for us to spend a little bit more time on just a few attributes rather than run quickly through a lot of them. Hopefully that will be a fruitful time for us. Now, I've already said the phrase divine attributes or attributes of God several times, but we haven't actually defined what exactly that means. You know, when we speak of the divine attributes, what exactly do we have in mind? Well, Francis Turretin, one of the great Reformed systematic theologians, has a very helpful and I think very clear explanation of what a divine attribute is. Turretin writes this. He says, "The divine attributes are the essential properties by which God makes Himself known to us who are weak, and those by which He is distinguished from creatures, or they are those which are attributed to Him according to the measure of our conception in order to explain His nature." And then just a little further down, Turretin writes that the attributes indicate perfections essential to the divine nature conceived by us as properties. Now, that may or may not sound very clear to you, but in that explanation of what the attributes are, Turretin points out at least four things that are important to note. First, he points out that the attributes are properties or their characteristics. You know, to be very specific, the divine attributes don't answer the question, who is God? The answer to the question, who is God, is Jehovah. God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit. The divine attributes don't answer the question, who is God? They answer the question, what is God like? You know, the divine attributes try, you know, hobbled by all of our creaturely finitude, they try to describe what God is like. But secondly, you know, the attributes, as Turretin points out, the attributes are the properties by which God makes Himself known to us in all of our weakness and all of our frailty. You know, these are the things that God chooses to reveal about Himself. You know, these aren't things that we figure out about God. It's not as if we come up with some sort of logical reasoning to figure out these things about God. But rather, these are things that God Himself has chosen to reveal to us. Now, these are the characteristics of God that He has displayed in order that we might know Him better. Turretin speaks about the attributes being given according to the measure of our conception. You know, God is revealing Himself, He's revealing what He is like in ways that we're able to understand. He doesn't reveal Himself in ways that we can't grasp. I mean, He does that too. But in these attributes, He is revealing Himself in ways that we actually can understand in order to know Him better. But then thirdly, Turretin points out that these attributes distinguish God from all, Turretin says, creatures. And by that he means all of creation. The divine attributes describe the God who is without counterpart. This is God in His otherness from us. And now there are ways in which the attributes can be reflected in the lives of God's people. But in their fullness, the attributes are describing the God who is utterly different, who is utterly distinct from all that He has made. So these are God as he is in distinction from all creatures, as Turretin says. But then fourthly, Turretin points out that the attributes are, in his words, essential to the divine nature. You know, these are the attributes, these are the perfections, the possession of which mark God out as being God. Now, we have to be somewhat precise there. We're not saying that these attributes are things that God has to display in order to be God. You know, we don't come to God with a sort of checklist, willing to call him God if and only if he meets all 10 of our qualifications that we demand. You know, that would be idolatry. That would be blasphemy. But rather, these are attributes that God has revealed to us. These aren't demands that we bring to him. These are attributes that he has revealed to us. It's as if God has said, I, who alone am God, I am these things. So the fact that God is these attributes, it doesn't make him God, but rather he is God. And the fact that all of these attributes describe him, that makes them divine attributes. So when Turretin says that these attributes are essential to the divine nature, he's pointing to this connection that these attributes disclosed to us by God, they describe what God is. They're part of, they are speaking of his nature. The attributes are not the ground of God's Godhead, but rather they are the description of his Godhead. In a sense, the divine attributes aren't a sort of resume that qualifies God to be God, but rather they're something more like a biography that describes to us the God who is. They are, in that respect, they are essential to his nature, as Turretin puts it. They're part of who he is. Now, of course, that does invest the divine attributes with a great deal of validating authority. For example, God has revealed himself to be eternal. Well, if I'm teaching in the seminary classroom and one day one of the students stands up and declares that he is divine, you know, there'd be a number of things I would want to discuss with that particular student. But among other things, you could say, no, you're not divine because God is eternal. You were born in 1995. Clearly, you're not God. You don't have these divine attributes. You know, the attributes do have that sort of validating authority. Someone can't claim to be God without displaying the attributes that God has revealed himself to possess. You know, God is God, and those who don't display these attributes are not God. So they do take on that sort of validating authority, but we should not ever understand them as things that God, or that qualify God to be God. He simply is God, and these are the attributes that he has revealed to us. So when we describe God, when we describe what he is like, these attributes, they are the descriptions that we use to describe him. And we use them because he has revealed them to us. These are who God has revealed himself to be. And when we think of the divine attributes, we need to also be very clear that these are not sort of component parts of who God is. These aren't sort of different characteristics that if you add them all up, at the end it equals God. But rather, these are different descriptions of the one being of the living God. You know, these are a list of the various finite perspectives that we have on the one undivided God. So it's not as if all the divine attributes are sort of puzzle pieces that when you put them all together, you get a full picture of God. That's not exactly the case. But rather, it's as if you were to give a man a statue and you were to ask that man to describe that statue, and then he handed you a list of 20 different descriptions. You know, those aren't constituent parts of the statue, They're simply all different ways of describing the one statue. That's more what the divine attributes are. Or another example, if you were to take my son, my son's attributes are not a list of my son's arms and my son's legs and my son's head and my son's hands and my son's feet. Now, the attributes of my son in this sense would be that he is kind and he's compassionate and he is, these are characteristics that you don't add up to make him, but rather they are different perspectives on the one person that just is him. Now, both of those examples would need some qualification, but the point for now simply is that these divine attributes are not building blocks that if you add them all together, you get God. But rather, these are different perspectives on the one undivided God who simply is who and what he is. They're not component parts of him. Now, all that being said, the attributes are, as you perhaps can imagine, mysterious in many ways. They describe the divine nature in ways that we can understand, and yet ways that show us that we never able fully to comprehend God. And because of that, it can be easy to see the divine attributes as sort of an abstract, perhaps even trivial list. Particularly in our own age, when we seem to want to so emphasize the personalness of God, the attributes can seem to be a little bit abstract, a little bit impersonal. They're things that you might be able to learn and list off. They're something that you can maybe sit here today and listen about them for a little while. But they don't really have a lot of relevance in your everyday life, in your faith. We can't understand the attributes in that way. If the divine attributes describe God as he has revealed himself to be, then knowing the divine attributes helps us to know God better. Knowing the divine attributes helps us to know God as he has revealed himself to be. When we look at the divine attributes, we are studying what God is like. And that practice, it's not arbitrary. Even in the passage that Reverend Claver read just a few minutes ago out of Exodus 34, we see that when God reveals himself to his people, he does so how? Well, by listing attributes. He describes himself in these divine attributes so that Moses, and then through Moses, God's people, can understand better who he is. Now, God's people always have sought to know him better through knowing his attributes, knowing what he's like. We read the same sort of thing in the New Testament. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, we see God set forth again by his attributes. There in 1 Timothy 1, Paul writes this. He says, "For this cause I obtained mercy, that in me first Jesus Christ might show forth all longsuffering for a pattern to them which should hereafter believe on him to life everlasting. Now unto the King, eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen." In setting forth the wonder and the excellency of God the Son, Paul rattles off this rather brief list of some of God's attributes. And through that series of words, Paul is setting forth something of who God is, in order that we might praise him for who he is. So in knowing and studying the attributes of God, we come to know God as he is. And so it's not something just to consider for a time and then move on from. Knowing the attributes of God enables us to know God better. And so we ought to know these attributes, we ought to meditate on them, because through them, we come to know the triune God better. And in that way, the divine attributes have profound implications in our own lives, in the lives of our congregations, in the lives of others. When we know God as he is, when we know him and understand him better, we're able to grow in our love for him, We're able to grow in our trust in Him, and we're able to have everything be changed because we know Him better. Now, in that regard, I often think of what was really one of the more powerful moments of my early parenting life. Nothing particularly dramatic, but for me, it was profound nonetheless. My wife and I just had had our first child. We were living overseas in this teeny little flat, and our daughter in the night just starts crying, and that's putting it mildly. She's screaming at the top of her lungs. The walls were shaking, tiny little lungs, and the whole place is reverberating. Well, she was alone in the room. If you think about it, you know, all alone in a dark room, you're new to the world, you don't know anything, you don't understand anything beyond what you're able to see. Things that are strange, things that are unknown are all around you. And so I go to the door and I open the door, and as soon as I walk in the room, there was silence. Now, of course, I've gone on to realize more and more that there was a decent bit of manipulation at work as well. But alongside that manipulation, there was the simple fact that someone she knew had come into the room. You know, nothing else had changed. Nothing that was bothering her before had changed. Nothing that might have been making her uncomfortable had changed. Nothing that had been uncertain had suddenly been made certain. Nothing scary had been altered. Nothing really had changed. But there was someone in the room whom she knew. And that changed everything. And I think that it's similar with the Christian. You know, there are lots of things in this world that we don't know. There are lots of uncertainties, there are lots of fears, there's lots of anxieties, there's lots of trouble. There's more than enough to unsettle us. But when we know God, and as we come to know Him better, as we come to understand more of who He is, we know the man in the room, so to speak. And that changes everything. It doesn't take away the uncertainty. It doesn't remove things that are pressing on us or trying us. But when you know the man in the room, so to speak, all these other uncertainties lose their power because you know Him. And your apprehension of what lies ahead for you, or your apprehension about what will befall you, it doesn't rest on all those things that you don't know. It rests on Him. And while you might not know all of these other things, you do know Him. You know more about your God. And that makes all the difference. So these attributes need to be not just an intellectual exercise, but a spiritual and a devotional exercise as well. This is the revelation of our God. And in knowing these things, we come to know Him better. Now, in an attempt to come to something of this knowledge, as I said, you could list a string of attributes and just say a sentence about each one and fill all the time that we have today. Rather than doing that, I want us to take two attributes in particular and look at them in at least a little bit more depth. And the first one that we want to consider, we'll look at it and probably have to wrap up with it in the afternoon and then move on to look at the second one. The first one we want to consider is the attribute of aseity. Now, that word probably sounds unfamiliar to you. Perhaps it doesn't. But I think that divine aseity really is the leading divine attribute. Now, all of the divine attributes are equally glorious. They're equally important. They all equally speak of the God who is. And yet, you have to start somewhere. You have to begin with an attribute. You have to identify one attribute as the leading one. And it seems, in my opinion, that the leading attribute of God is His aseity. This is the attribute without which we can't fully understand any of the other ones. I'm not alone in that opinion, so you don't have to fear that I'm leading you astray. Divine aseity very frequently is considered one of the leading divine attributes. But that being said, What is aseity? I suspect it's not a word that comes up in your daily conversation. So what is divine aseity? Well, the doctrine of divine aseity is the recognition that God possesses the fullness of being, life, and existence in himself, and therefore he is dependent on nothing outside of himself. Now, in a word, he is self-existent, or he's independent. There have been a number of different names that have been used for this attribute, independence, self-existence. I think that the word aseity is probably the best. It comes from the Latin. God is a se, he is from himself. A from se himself, he is a se. He has aseity. That's how the kind of the language works. And it's getting at this fact that his life, his existence is from himself and not from anything else. That's what's being meant by this idea of divine aseity. I think it, like I said, there are different words you could use, but I think aseity is the most helpful, it's the best, because it speaks positively of this fact that God's being, his life, his existence, it's from himself. Now, when we think about God's aseity, his independence in that way, it has both a positive aspect and a negative aspect. Positively, aseity points to the fact that God has the fullness of life in himself and of himself and from himself. God is in himself the fullness of being. Now, we see that perhaps most powerfully in Exodus chapter 3, in verses 14 and 15. When God calls Moses out of Midian, calls him to return to Egypt to lead the descendants of Abraham to freedom. As y'all probably know, at that point, Moses had been in exile in Egypt for about 40 years. He's tending sheep for his father-in-law, Jethro. He's at the base of Mount Horeb, or Mount Sinai, as it also is known. And as Moses is walking along with the sheep, we read in Exodus chapter 3, verse 2, the scriptures say, "And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed." So Moses is with the sheep. He sees this eerie sight. There's this bush engulfed in flame that was yet not consumed. Now, strangely, burning bushes weren't entirely uncommon in that part of the world at that time. You know, the extreme heat, the extreme dryness, shrubs would at times burst into flame. But those bushes, they burned. They were diminished. They were consumed by the flame. The heat of the flame took the fuel of the bush to support itself, and the bush was devoured. It burned up. But not this bush. As the end of verse 2 says, "And the bush was not consumed." In fact, that's precisely what grabbed Moses' attention. In verse 3, we read on to see this. "And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt." What grabbed Moses' attention wasn't the flame. What grabbed Moses' attention was the fact that the bush was unaffected by that flame. The bush was in the middle of the fire, and it wasn't burnt. Now, as you know, this so often is referred to as the burning bush. But in a sense, it's kind of a regrettable name. The glory of the bush, what drew Moses inexorably to the bush, was the fact that even though it was encircled in flames, it wasn't consumed. It's the not burning bush, in a certain sense. And as Moses draws near to the bush, he heard those marvelous words, words that must have made his heart shudder. In verse 5, We read this. Moses hears, "Draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. The angel of the Lord, God himself, is there in the midst of the bush, in the flame that burns and yet leaves the bush untouched." Well, you know, God goes on to command Moses to go to Egypt and first to meet with the elders of Israel to tell them that he's come at God's command to lead them out of Egyptian shackles. But Moses suspects that when he does that, when he, you know, perhaps largely a forgotten man by then, when he comes and tells the elders that God has sent him to be the instrument of their deliverance, they won't believe him. Moses thinks he'll need to have proof that he's actually been sent from God. So Moses says to God, down in verse 13, "Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel and say unto them, the God of your fathers hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them?" Moses here asks for God's name. And that's incredibly significant. Yeah, some of you may know, in Old Testament times, names were incredibly important. Names weren't just a succession of sounds or letters that would help you address one person and not another person. No, a name said something about the internal reality of a person. Your name captured and spoke of who you are. So in asking for God's name, Moses is seeking a window into God's very character. He's asking for a glimpse of what God is like in his name. And in verses 14 and 15, God gives Moses his answer. Beginning in verse 14, we read, "And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. And God said moreover unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, hath sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations." Now, in verse 15, if you're reading along with me, you'll see there that all capital letters are being used, speaking there of the holy name Jehovah. And then before that, in verse 14, God had told Moses that what that name Jehovah means. It means, I am that I am. I am that I am. So when Moses asked God for his name, and remember the significance of names here, when Moses asks God for a window into his own holy being, God says, in essence, my being is myself. I am my own being. What God is saying here is that he is existence. He has his being in himself and from himself. He doesn't depend on anything outside of himself for his existence or for his being. He himself is the foundation of his own being. Moses Maimonides, who was a Jewish scholar in the 12th century, he put it this way. He says that this word that we call Jehovah, that word is simply the expression of existence as an attribute. God is saying that one of his attributes is existence. And that's precisely what's being communicated by the spectacle that drew Moses to the burning bush in the first place. You know, normal fires, fires that burned and consumed bushes, they burned and consumed those bushes because they need the bush. The fire needed the fuel of the wood in order to exist. The flame was dependent on the bush. Without the bush, the fire would just simply cease to be. When the bush was wholly burnt, the flame would disappear. The flame was dependent on the bush. It needed the fuel. But the fire that Moses sees, the holy fire of God, it didn't need the bush. The bush was unconsumed. It was untouched by the fire that raged all around it. The flame didn't need the fuel. It didn't need the bush. It existed in and of itself. It was dependent on nothing outside of itself. And it was out of this fire, it was out of this fire that didn't need anything to exist, that God declared his name to be Jehovah. I am that I am. So in this precious old covenant name of God, God is declaring himself to be the independent one. The one who has his existence in himself and of himself. The one who has the fullness of life in himself and not from any other. Now, as God goes on in verse 15 to trace out, this will have implications for the Israelites will experience. Because God is himself and always is himself, he'll always be God to his people. He'll be the God of the covenant. He'll deliver his people. He'll deliver them again. God is himself, and that has implications for his people. But in this most personal, most intimate, most proper name that we find in the Old Testament, the name Jehovah, God is asserting that he is being. He is existence. He is life. And the fullness of this divine life is made all the richer in the New Testament when we come to see God as Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. You know, there is within God the fullness of joy, the fullness of bliss, the fullness of communion, the fullness of life in all of the rich dynamism of what that means. You see the dynamic of this with striking poignancy in the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John opens in John chapter 1 at verse 2 by telling us that in the beginning was the Word, in the beginning of John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Then later in John, in the high priestly prayer of John chapter 17, Jesus prays to the Father in John 17 verse 5 and says, "And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was." And then if you skip down to verse 26, Jesus refers to the love wherewith thou hast loved me. So the triune God in himself and by himself has life of perfect communion, perfect glory, perfect bliss, perfect love. There was this love amongst the persons of the Trinity even before the creation of time. And that's one of the things that's so glorious about the high priestly prayer of John 17. You know, throughout it, from so many different angles, the Son is praying to the Father regarding the accomplishment of the great work of redemption, whereby God's people will be folded in to the perfect life that God always has had in its perfect fullness within himself. Herman Bavinck, a theologian of the late 19th century and into the 20th, writes this. He says of God that God is a boundless ocean of being. And that's true. And to expand upon that, God also is a boundless ocean of life. And it's into that ocean that he's bringing his people. You know, this is the positive aspect of divine aseity. God has the fullness of life in and of himself. He doesn't have life from outside of himself. He doesn't have his existence from outside of himself. It's within himself. At times, I give the example of my own name. My full name sometimes people chuckle at it, is Stephen Goodnight Myers. The name points to who I am. Stephen points to my father. His name was Stephen. Goodnight, I'm named after my great uncle. Myers, I come from the Myers family. If you grew up in the part of the world where I grew up and you were to hear my name, you would know a great deal about me simply from my name, because you would know these families, you would know my father, you would know about me because of my name. But my name is pointing to other people. I'm defined by them. When God gives his name, he says, I am that I am, because his meaning, his identity, his existence doesn't come from outside of himself. It all is within himself. He has his life. He has existence. He has being in himself and of himself, not from anything outside of himself. Now, this is the positive aspect of divine aseity. God simply is his own being. Now, just one more place in the scriptures to point you. In Acts chapter 17, verses 24 and 25, we read this, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth life to all and breath and all things. God is the one who gives life to all. He himself is life, and then he gives life to all of creation. So this positive aspect of aseity is that God has the fullness of being, the fullness of life in himself. That's the positive aspect of divine aseity. But there's also a negative aspect, a negative in the sense that it points to something that is not. And this negative aspect is very closely connected to the positive aspect. And this negative aspect is that God is not dependent on anything outside of himself. He is fully, completely, radically independent. Not only does he positively have life within himself, but he negatively doesn't need life from anything outside of himself. This part of aseity also is very evident in the scriptures. It's implicit in the scene at the burning bush that we've looked at already. We also see it in both Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and John chapter 1, verse 1. Genesis 1, verse 1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. John 1, verse 1 reads, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In both instances, we're told that at the beginning, there was God. Full stop. God existed, and God alone existed. There was no other being, there was no other entity, there was no other thing present except for God alone. And that means that God has to be self-existent. He has to have his being and his life from himself, because in the beginning there was no other thing present to be the source of his life and existence. Outside of God, there was nothing. Not in Genesis 1:1, but in Genesis 1:0. If you kind of push back behind Genesis 1:1, there's only God. There's nothing else. There's no other source from which God could have his life or his being or his existence. It's only from himself. There's nothing else from which it could come. So this is the negative aspect of divine aseity. As a function of his deity, God is dependent on nothing outside of himself for his being and for his life. He is fully and radically independent. Now, having seen there something of what aseity is, we'll take just a couple of minutes to look at some of the implications of divine aseity. It can seem rather abstract, perhaps, but what all does it mean? Well, it means a number of things. But for one, divine aseity implies that everything else depends on God for its being. Since God is the only one who has his being in and of himself, it means that everything else in all of reality depends on God for its existence. He is the source of it all. As the Apostle Paul states in Acts 17:28, in him we live and move and have our being. It's in him that all things have their being. Outside of him, nothing has being. Everything is dependent upon him. Boethius, who was a Christian Roman philosopher and theologian, he put it this way. He lived in the late 5th and early 6th century. He put it this way. He said, the divine substance is being itself, and from it comes being. Everything else that exists, everything else that is, depends on God for its existence. Now, that can sound a little bit abstract, but what it means is that God is fully and radically in control of everything. Everything is dependent on him for its very being and for its very existence. This is the fullness of what we mean when we speak of divine sovereignty. That God isn't just in control of everything that exists. He's not just able to control it. But everything that is depends on him for its very being, for its very existence. Now, of course, God can't not exist. But hypothetically, if God were to not be there, everything else would simply disappear. Because without God, nothing has existence. Nothing has being. And that's the enormity and the depth of God's authority in all of creation. And what that does within the Christian life is to bring us a great deal of comfort. And now I recognize that some of y'all might be wondering where the relevance of this is. Think, well, they invited the wrong guy to come this year. This is a little bit useless. But there's tremendous comfort in this understanding that God has being in and of himself. You know, so often when we're doing the Lord's work, whether that be in pastoral ministry or whether it be in serving in church office or simply serving within the life of the church, whether it be within the confines of the church or in witness to unbelieving neighbors or family or friends, whenever we're doing the Lord's work, there's tremendous comfort in realizing that the one who sent you, the one whose work you are doing, is the one who simply is being itself. He is the one upon whom all things depend. He is the one who controls all things in this radical way. The God whom we worship and serve is worthy of our worship. And he also is a God in whom we can trust and rest, a God on whom we can rely, because he holds all things in the deep of his hand. He doesn't just come to the world and possess such immense power that he's able to orchestrate things. No, he is the God who gives everything its being. Without him, nothing exists. And so when we go about laboring in his service, we can have this great comfort that we're serving the God who has this radical foundational control over all things. He deserves our worship, and he controls all these things that we see. And so we can trust him, we can rely on him, we can pour ourselves out in his service, because he is the God who simply is life and being. Now that's something of the doctrine of divine aseity, that God has his life in and of himself. He has his life, he has his being in and of himself. Now, we moved through that somewhat quickly, but I think rather than move on to look at the next attribute that we'll look, maybe I'll stop there rather than begin into one that we then have to pause. But in this divine aseity, as I said, I think it's the leading divine attribute, because it sets before us, before we look at anything else about God, it sets clearly before us that He is the God who simply is. He doesn't depend on anything for His existence. He doesn't need the world. He doesn't need us. He is, in His triune perfection, perfect, having His own being, having His own life, having His own existence, and needing nothing else. What a joy it is to serve that God who is the fullness of life, and who gives life to His people, and who draws them into His own life. What a privilege and a joy it is to be His and to serve Him, knowing something of the glory of who He is. At the risk of not wanting to speak out of turn, I don't know if it is at all customary to take questions. If anyone has a question, I know some of this can be incredibly abstract. Does anyone have a question that I could at least attempt to answer? And again, I don't. If questions are never asked, I'm asking you to do something out of turn. I apologize. Well, perhaps we'll go a little bit early for lunch then, I suppose. Again, when we come back in the afternoon, we'll be looking at an attribute that I think, you know, lest you wonder, I think might be a little bit more easily accessible. And so hopefully that's a teaser to want to come attentively to the second address. But we've seen here something of the divine aseity, and what a privilege it is to worship and to serve the God who simply is being and life and the fullness thereof. Thank you.